Communicating Disaster Risk Reduction Science and More with Francisco Fregonio Peña. Active citizens build resilient cities.
A Doctor of Philosophy, or PhD, is a postgraduate doctoral degree. This is the epitome of the higher education chain for individuals who seek to master their field of interest, want to contribute to science, or simply love research. In general, the process of obtaining a PhD requires students to conduct literature reviews and provide original research, results, and scientific writing. The PhD is a rewarding process, albeit an exhausting one. The journey includes endless amounts of works, experiments and tests, presentation and conferences, published papers and sleepless nights. The process requires 3 to 7 years, depending on the chosen topic and university. Some students perceive these as an exciting opportunity to acquire knowledge, methodologies and software, all of which are useful for the thesis and eventual jobs prospects. However, this pursuit has been shown to correlate with high amounts of stress and depression. While the goal remains to produce both a thesis and dissertation, it's equally important to maintain a healthy life, both physically and socially. Welcome to Communicating Disaster Risk Reduction Science and More podcast. My name is Rosella and I will be your host for today. By the way, this week, the show is celebrating its first year on air.
Thank you, Rosella, Radiofonica, ladies and gentlemen, for being with us today. It's been a fantastic journey of new learnings and collaborations with students and professionals. We are here as a science-based community, serving to raise awareness of today's happenings.
Now, Francisco is going to share some of his own experiences striking a balance as a PhD student. So, to kick off the second season, what can you tell us about the PhD life?
It definitely changes you, in a good way, of course. I can compare it to going to work, but in the academic world. It involves responsibility, discipline, focus, and a little extra effort to fulfill the task. It is another way of living.
Just for background, Francisco is a third-year PhD student studying flood risk at the University of Florence in Italy. Run us through one day in the life of a PhD student.
My day-to-day varies, given I'm involved in different activities, such as developing tutorials, learning new software, and sometimes teaching. However, generally, you can find me working on flood modeling.
I got an idea!
Which involves the use of hydraulic software, GIS tools, and some programming skills. Personally, I prefer to work without any noise because it requires a lot of concentration, while others may prefer background music. I think it's a personal choice.
In general, how much do you have to read per day?
Well, reading scientific papers is something I try to do on a regular basis. At the beginning of the PhD, I remember feeling lost on the math and scientific methods after going through only the first few pages of a paper. It was really tough. Now, I'm able to obtain key information from my readings more efficiently. It's a matter of practice. The more you read, the better you're able to understand the content and link the ideas to your papers for potential reference purposes.
Why did you decide to start the PhD?
When I was enrolled in my undergraduate studies in Monterrey, Mexico, I noticed a lack of experts in flood risk management. I interpreted this as a serious deficit, given Mexico is one of the most affected countries by hydrometeorological phenomena in the world. So my goal from then on was to become an expert in the area. I saw the opportunity in front of me and I went for it.
How does it feel to work in an academic environment? Do you enjoy it?
Indeed, I think working in academia has several advantages.
Can you make us some examples?
Sure, working remotely. I don't always need to be at the office, given the software to develop projects is stored on my computer. I am results-based oriented with my supervisor. Therefore, the working schedule and work location are flexible. This means that I can take off a day of work during the week, but work during weekends. Personally, I like this modality.
I'm not sure I would like to jeopardize my weekend for work.
For some PhDs, this is just the way of living. We have the ability to schedule ourselves as needed, since another advantage of undergoing this type of program is the autonomy. For instance, I have checks once a week with my supervisor for research updates. I like the freedom and challenges of addressing particular problems related to my research. Fortunately, this formula has worked well for both parties, but it can be a double-edged sword for students who require daily guidance or prefer a more social environment.
I've heard that doing a PhD is full of solitude and reduces your chances to meet new people. Do you agree with that?
I think that depends on students' individual personalities. People who are more outgoing will remain so, while people who are more introverted may choose to invest more of their time in their work.
That would make sense. What are some of the challenges you personally have faced in your own research?
I feel frustrated at times when my results are not what I expected. It took me months to perform the correct calibration and validation processes for the models used in my first paper. I had to double-check the input data and calculation methods because the flood profile and extent were underestimating the reference model. Overall, instead of looking at situations like this as a waste of time, I see them as a key part of the learning process.
That's awesome to hear. Now it's time to go listen to My Voice 120. We will be back very soon with Communicating Disaster Risk Reduction Science and More.
Hello, my name is Sylvia Hodlik. I'm a Polish student of mathematics and graduate in informatics and econometrics. My area of interest is data science. In particular, I deal with building econometrics models that reflect reality to a certain extent and are used to forecast future events. Econometric models reveal relationships among variables to forecast future scenarios. As a professional in the field, you must understand the database by performing the analysis of time series that you are working with, in order to develop models that can provide insights of historical patterns or past trends. Ultimately, the results serve as a baseline for measurement and prediction. In disaster risk analysis, for example, factors that make nations vulnerable to disaster phenomena can be accounted for future predictions. We can explore ways on how countries are affected depending on their socioeconomic characteristics, exposure, or susceptibility to risks. Population growth in disaster-prone geographical locations and the effects of extreme weather events has increased the importance of understanding the underlying causes. If you can locate the bullseye and destination of hurricanes or tornadoes through better predictions, we are one step ahead to improve disaster preparedness and mitigation strategies. Modeling and forecasting extremes are very challenging topics, which require flexible yet interpretable models with solid theoretical support criteria. Assumptions are needed to support the model because past trends are dynamic and often affected by non-observable factors that make it very hard to base forward-looking decisions on past behavior. Moreover, a high level of detail in the data is required, but it usually results in a lower forecast accuracy. That also happens due to the occurrence of outliers that create noise disturbing the model. The goal of forecasting is not to predict the future, but to tell you what you need to know to take meaningful action in the present. For more information, you can contact sylvia.hodlik@gmail.com. And remember, active citizens build resilient cities.
We are back with Communicating Disaster Risk Reduction Science and More. In your opinion, how accurate are weather predictions and forecasts, and can we rely on them?
Approximations are not an absolute truth and can lose accuracy over time. Can we rely on them? Weather forecasts may be very accurate for 1 or 2 days, but I'm not so sure about a week in advance, at least in Perugia.
I couldn't agree more. Now, let's talk about the scientific writing. What are the sections of a scientific publication?
Most of the journal papers I read include the following 8 sections: the abstract, introduction, materials and methods, procedure, results, discussion, and bibliography.
Okay, and what is the first step when writing a manuscript?
Considering there is no suggested writing order, and I'm relatively new in the world of scientific research, I will tell you about my personal experience. First, I begin by preparing some figures and tables, so I have something to write about. The caption and image must be self-explanatory and easy to understand. The selection depends on the allowance number provided by the journal. and in case the limit number is exceeded, it can be included as supplementary material.
And then what's next? The abstract?
In fact, I leave the abstract until the very end. The abstract is the outline, the executive summary of the content, the big picture after the paper is completed. It contains bits of each section. This gives readers and researchers a condensed version rather than reading the whole publication. Anyway, after creating the figures, I continue with data, materials, and methods. This section answers the question of how and where the problem was studied. A full description of the study area, data sources, and methods are explained in detail. For example, using my publication as a reference, I introduce the main characteristics of the Tiber River Basin. Subsequently, I describe how the 2D hydraulic model works, how the numerical scheme runs, and which formulas are used for the calculations. These are usually straightforward since you have already done the experiment.
Okay, then you continue with the introduction, right?
That's correct. The introduction should be concise and structured from a global to a particular perspective. It should reflect your results and implications. Previous works on the topic are cited and developed logically from one section to the next.
Okay.
Then, it's necessary to describe the procedure. For me, it was easier to create a flowchart and describe every passage. Step A, B, C, D, until I reach the desired results. The results section focuses on what was found. Statistical tests, performance metrics, maps are included here. All writing is reported from a neutral point of view, this is very important, and any comments must stick exclusively to the findings. There are no opinions, nor conclusions or statements, only the results as they are. And last but not least, what does it all mean? The discussion is considered the most valuable section of the manuscript. This is where the interpretation and explanation of key findings are defended. Do the results support the predictions? If not, why? Do the results agree or disagree with other studies? How does this study advance a particular area of research? A final paragraph including the future research and significance is also required.
Are we missing something?
Yes. Choose an effective title and appropriate keywords. While the title is tailored depending on the target audience and results, keywords should be chosen carefully to improve the search of papers on a selected topic.
In today's show, we talked about the life of PhD students and the structure of scientific papers. Stay tuned for our next show, Geojournalism and Citizen Science.
Get to know our work a little better by visiting our social media platforms, Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram as Guaredoc or Francisco Febronio Peña. And remember, active citizens
build resilient cities.
Goodbye.
Communicating Disaster Risk Reduction, Science, and More with Francisco Febronio Peña. Active citizens build resilient cities.